You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of May, 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up on the show, the Gulf States explore closer ties in the region. A former captain in the British Army breaks his silence on a top-secret botched mission in Iraq in 2003. Iran says it has hanged a man who spied for Israel. And we'll check in with our city-hopping editor, Andrew Tuck, from his perch in Paris. We'll also have a few songs for you and a chat with our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now here's Nick Kelly with the news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Attempts to form a government in Greece collapsed today, jolting financial markets at the prospect leftists, opposed to the terms of an EU bailout, could sweep to victory in a June election and nudge the Eurozone crisis into a dangerous new phase. European leaders say that they will cut off funding for Greece if it rejects the bailout, which would almost certainly mean an exit from the European single currency. Speaking at a forum in Istanbul, the German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle said Greece must stick to its reform commitments if it wanted to receive further aid and remain in the Eurozone.
It is absolutely clear that we want to stay together in the Eurozone. We do not want to exclude no one, nobody. We want to stay together. But of course, solidarity is not a one-way. Solidarity means that you have to fulfill and keep your promises.
The new French president, François Hollande, called for a European pact for growth to balance out German-driven austerity measures in his inaugural address today, hours before taking his challenge to Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin. President Hollande was sworn in with all the pomp of the French Republic at the Élysée Palace. Socialist members such as Hollande's campaign chief, Pierre Moscovici, said they were behind the new president in his vision for the future of Europe.
And I think Mr. Hollande, he chose the right words in order to tell the French, now it's time to get together and to rebuild Europe and to succeed in the country and to make an effort for youth, for education. Well, and for us, of course, it was a very moving moment because we fought so hard for it to happen.
A presidential jet carrying François Hollande was hit by lightning en route to Berlin and forced to turn back to Paris. But the newly inaugurated president was unharmed and took off again in another plane. Banks, already struggling with shrinking demand and soaring bad loans in austerity-hit Italy, will face more difficulties in raising funds after rating agency Moody's carried out a mass downgrade of local lenders. Reuters Italy chief economics correspondent Gavin Jones says the move would further increase a widening gap between European economies.
Well, it contributes to widening this growing gap that we're seeing between Germany on the one hand, you know, which is powering ahead. GDP rose 0.5% today, and Italian GDP contracted by 0.8%. This kind of two-speed Europe is something that is one of the main problems, and this just contributes to that problem.
The United Nations nuclear watchdog and Iran will meet again next week after what was termed a good exchange of views during 2 days of talks on the Islamic State's atomic program. Following the meeting, the IAEA Deputy Director General Helen Neckart spoke to reporters.
The primary focus of our discussions was how to clarify issues related to possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. We had a good exchange of views, and we will meet again on Monday.
At least 21 people were killed today when Syrian security forces opened fire at a crowd in the central town of Khan Sheikhoun during a visit by a UN monitoring team. A spokesman for the rebel military council gave a higher death toll, saying at least 50 were killed in the attack, during which a car belonging to a United Nations team was hit. And at least 42 people, including 30 Islamist militants, were killed in Yemen last night and today, as the government pressed ahead with a new US-backed offensive against insurgents in the south. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick Kelly, with the news. And it is now 5 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Londonból, ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London kala, Monocle 24 desu.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sin a Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα, τεμά on Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, βουρσε Monocle 24.
Λόντον καρα, Monocle 24.
The six Gulf states met yesterday in the Saudi capital to discuss closer cooperation. But this is going to be a long, slow process. It looks like the next meeting is going to be in December. For his analysis on the situation, we're joined now by Shashank Joshi, Associate Fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, and he's on the line from his home in London now. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hey, some are calling this an attempt at a closer EU-style marriage they're looking at, but it can't be that close if they're meeting next in December.
No, in fact, the comparison with the EU is fundamentally misleading. These states have had unity since the 1980s. The GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, was formed in response to what they saw as this overwhelming, subversive, sectarian political threat from who else but, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which had only had, changed government in a revolutionary style in 79. But in all those decades, they have never managed to attain the same degree of economic or military unity that the European Union has forged over the years. A few years ago, they tried to have a common currency, but Abu Dhabi decided it would pull out after the headquarters were announced to be in Riyadh, the Saudi capital. So these states have a lot of cultural familiarity. They all, of course, composed mainly of Arabic speakers. They are all ethnically Arabs. They have even a shared political culture in terms of the television stations they watch, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, and many names will be familiar with your listeners. But fundamentally, there just isn't that glue that binds them together, and this is basically an effort for Saudi Arabia to pull other states into its orbit. And I'm afraid it's really not going to work.
But tell us, Joshua, is it just that the Saudi is so... Saudi's so keen for this and not the other states? They have these similar...
Some of them are keen, of course. I should specify Bahrain, of course. Bahrain is a state, a small Shia-majority state that has a Sunni government into which Saudi Arabia sent troops last year to crush a rebellion. Now, Bahrain is a relatively poor state, and it has really become a de facto province of Saudi Arabia. So the royal family there, which, of course, wants to survive, is keen on a sort of ever-closer union. Other states, however, which are more zealously guarding their independence, particularly Qatar, which maintains ties with Iran, the UAE, which also likes to balance its policy between Saudi Arabia and Iran, keep channel open to Tehran. And so some of the states that are particularly poor, Bahrain, but also to the west, looking at Jordan, which isn't a Gulf state, but has been invited in to the GCC in a strange move. Those countries want Saudi Arabian money, and so they're open to putting themselves under Saudi Arabian leadership. But most countries, although they want to have some degree of unity and club together, they just don't trust Saudi Arabia not to exercise an overweening influence on them.
Okay, so on the club side, what if they were to get together and have a closer union, what would be the one thing that they'd have the best chance of agreement on, would you say?
That's a very interesting question, I think, actually, very interesting. I think perhaps most promising would be economics. Yes, they did struggle to get a common exchange rate, a common currency, but I think the prospects for a sort of the freer movement of goods, the freer movement of services, and harmonization on certain economic policies, I think those are possible. I think that's a low-hanging fruit. But if we step back and ask, what's motivating this? Well, it's not really economics, really. It's about security. It's about concern over new resurgent Shia movements that are the Gulf Arabs think are led by Iran, particularly in somewhere like Bahrain. It's about pushing away Iran and saying, look, if you try anything, we're all unified and we'll fight you back. So it's really about security. But of course, as long as the United States is sitting there with bases in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in, of course, a number of other countries in the Gulf, there just isn't the incentive for them to take the steps they need for unity when they know Washington will bail them out in the final instance. If Iran were ever to attack them, really, their own militaries would be nothing short of useless. It would be the Americans who did all the heavy lifting.
Wow. So after yesterday's meeting and this delay now, the next meeting, what was accomplished? What came out of yesterday, would you say?
I don't think an awful lot did come out of yesterday, actually. I think we got an indication of Saudi Arabian fears, anxieties, and their intentions, and their promise that this was not something that was just a flash in the pan last year. Last year, of course, they spent $130 billion on their own domestic spending program and extended an invitation into the Gulf Cooperation Council to both Jordan and Morocco, two countries, two monarchies, who are, of course, not Gulf Arab states. They are further to the west. Now, what that told us is the Saudi Arabians are afraid. They're afraid of Iran. They're afraid of their own domestic uncertainties. And they're afraid, of course, also of abandonment by the United States, because, of course, they saw the way in which the U.S. dropped Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. So what came out is the sense that Saudi Arabia isn't going to drop this issue and it's going to make real efforts, both in monetary terms but in diplomatic terms, to carve out a common policy and to carve out some sort of unity. Now, really, we have seen these efforts over the years before. As I said, there was a currency effort a few years ago. They haven't amounted to much. So, we've had a brief, fleeting year of Arab unity, particularly on Libya, where the Arab League and the GCC both fell in line behind the anti-Gaddafi policy.
Yes.
We've had some unity on Syria, where, of course, Saudi Arabia and Qatar are both anti-Assad, and of course they want to break the link between Assad and Iran. But all of these things are short-term, and when Assad falls or when the situation there fades away and is but a distant memory, what's really holding these states together? And I think there simply is too much dividing them for us to see any real movement to place themselves under the big Saudi Arabian umbrella.
Can we stand back a bit to look at like a whole worldview? And this is maybe too big of a question, but what do you think is in the world's interest with this group of states?
I think it's a bit idealistic to say this, but in the world's interest is to have these stale, stagnant, sclerotic monarchies realize that the greatest threat doesn't come from Iran, but comes from within, and their own stiff, rigid political structures that don't give their people genuine voices in government. And that to the extent that Iran is trying to meddle, to the extent that Iran is trying to interfere with Shia minorities inside their countries, all of that can be neutered quite easily by giving the Shia minorities equal rights and not spreading poisonous anti-Shia rhetoric, in order to sort of painting these people as Iranian stooges. I think it's in the world's interest that we don't see Saudi Arabia collapse and get taken over by fundamentalists. It's in our interest we don't see the Bahraini Shia opposition get radicalized because they feel that Saudi Arabia is oppressing them. It's in our interest that we see real, genuine, early reform and that we don't indulge their obsession with Iran and that we don't give them a free pass on reform just because we need their military bases and we need their geopolitical alliance for ourselves to counter Iranian influence as well. So fundamentally, that's in our interest. On a more cynical level, perhaps, on a more sort of ground level, these are very rich countries. All right. So if you look at the way of the last couple of years, it was Gulf Arab financial institutions or sovereign wealth funds that recapitalized Western banks that pumped huge amounts of money into Europe and North America, and that have enormous clout because of their hydrocarbon reserves and their ability to, the world's biggest underlying stocks of energy. So it's in our interest, I suppose, that they use these in responsible, sensible ways and not on big white elephants within their own countries, and certainly not on funding proxy wars in somewhere like Syria, Palestine, or Lebanon, where a lot of Arab money has gone. And really, I think our priority from the outside is to make sure this part of the world develops in a way that maximizes human capital and doesn't simply perpetuate the status quo and send huge amounts of money to enriching very small elites within these countries.
Thank you very much. Very interesting to hear you. That was Monocle contributor Shashank Joshi. We'll be right back.
On the latest episode of Section D, we delve into the realm of faith and design. We visit a new large chapel in the heart of Helsinki, a synagogue in New York that's made its home in a former Gucci store, and we discuss church chairs, nuns' habits, and how graphic design is bringing religious literature into the 21st century.
The anonymity that wearing the habit has given nuns historically. I mean, there are stories of them carrying ammunition hidden under their habit, you know, during the war, and all sorts of interesting things.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers, putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
And now a bit of music for you. This is Coop Island Blues by Coop, featuring Anna Brune, Coop de Grasse. A man Iran says was spying for Israeli intelligence was hung in Tehran this morning. Majid Jamali Fashi, who was in his 20s, had been found guilty of murdering an Iranian nuclear scientist. Iran says the man had a fair trial. Israel is not commenting. Fawaz Jirjaz, professor of Middle Eastern politics and international relations at the London School of Economics, joins us now on the line. Good evening.
Good evening to you, Nancy.
Can you tell me something about this, first of all, the young man who is alleged to have been spying for Israel? Do you know anything about him?
We know very little about Mr. Fathi. We know that he's in his 20s. We know, according to the Iranian authorities, allegedly that he left Iran and was trained by the Mossad. We know, allegedly, that he made confessions that he was part of the Mossad, the Israeli secret service. And we also know that state media, the Iranian media, attended the trial, and his verdict was approved by the supreme leader today. He was executed today in the prison in Tehran. That's all we know about.
And I've read that no independent media were present at the trial.
Well, you're absolutely correct. Not only independent media was not present, we don't know whether he was really represented by an attorney. And we know that the judicial system in Iran is not transparent. There is no transparency, no accountability. And we also know that some of the opposition media basically have claimed that the killing of Professor Mohammadi in 2010, the physics professor, basically, in which Mr. Fathi is accused, in fact, he was part of the Green Movement. In fact, some of the opposition elements accused the Iranian regime of being behind the killing of Professor Mohammadi. And that's why, in the absence of independent media, in the absence of an independent attorney, in the absence of an accountability, the situation becomes extremely difficult to decipher. But the big point is the following. Four nuclear scientists have been assassinated in Iran. Under extremely suspicious conditions. Iran accuses Israel of being behind the killings. Israel has not denied the accusations. There is increasing evidence pointing out towards Israel as the culprit behind some of the assassinations. The United States has denied having any hand behind the killings of the scientists. In Iran, the killing of nuclear scientists has become really a critical, significant matter for the Iranian regime, because basically it exposes the vulnerability of the Iranian regime in the eyes of the population.
Okay, and just to be clear, you're saying there is mounting evidence that does support the idea that Israel is behind it?
I think so. I think even some American intelligence officials, former intelligence officials, have made it very clear that Israel has gone to great lengths to try to undermine the Iranian nuclear program by killing scientists who work at various universities and who contribute to the development of the Iranian nuclear program. There is no credible, no hard evidence, but the reality is there's a war taking place between Israel and Iran, and Israel has gone out of its way to try to destroy the Iranian nuclear program. So I don't think this is far-fetched if we say that there is increasing evidence that Israel might have had a hand in the assassination of the Iranian scientists.
Okay, and on this scientist we're talking about this evening, Professor Massoud Ali Mohammadi. Now, do we think that he could be on that list too? It's interesting. And what evidence do we have that he actually was a green supporter of the green opposition movement inside Iran?
You know, Nancy, your questions themselves really raise important questions about the nature of evidence we're talking about. Think of how much we are speculating. First, we're saying that the Iranian authorities say that Professor Mohammadi was a physics professor at Tehran University who was assassinated by a Mossad-inspired Iranian agent. Mm-hmm. The opposition says Mr. Mohammadi was part of the Green Movement, the opposition movement to the Iranian regime. This tells you about the difficult situation of trying to really decipher the nature of the accusations. We don't know. We just don't have hard evidence. But the reality is all we know is that four nuclear scientists have been assassinated in Iran, and the four nuclear scientists have played a key role in the development of the Iranian nuclear program. Iran says Israel and the United States are behind the assassinations. The United States says no. It denies it. Israel is silent. Israel does not really comment on such actions.
In the circumstances in this particular assassination, and for which this young man was hung this morning, I think a bomb was detonated, some sort of explosive was detonated nearby. Would that be a Mossad-type thing to do in Tehran?
Well, Mossad has done many things and can do a great deal over, the last 30, 40 years. It really is one of the most potent and lethal intelligence services in the world. Empirical evidence that we have shows very clearly that the Mossad can strike at any place in the world, whether it's in neighboring countries, whether it's in the United Arab Emirates, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in Europe, or whether it's in Iran. Even the American intelligence services, including the CIA, they take the Mossad very seriously because of the skills and the lethal nature of its operators.
Well, we're not going to get the truth about this tonight, that's for sure, isn't it?
No. There is nothing set in stone. We don't have any kind of really concrete, credible evidence. All we know is that there is a secret undercover war taking place between Iran on the one hand and the Americans and the Europeans and the Israelis. And I think the United States and the Western powers and Israel are waging a very, complex war in order to undermine and destroy the Iranian nuclear program. The Americans have made it very clear they don't basically assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. The Israelis are being very silent about that. There is tentative evidence pointing out that Israel is trying to do Iran harm and stop its nuclear program. That's all we know. That's all we know at this particular moment.
Fawaz Jurjaz, thank you very much. Fawaz Jurjaz is Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. And that was Up in Flames by Lucky Soul. In the next half hour on Midori House, a former British Army captain tells secrets from behind enemy lines. Jonathan Openshaw will be here to talk business, and Andrew Tuck will talk cities. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Nancy. Attempts to form a government in Greece collapsed today, jolting financial markets at the prospect leftists opposed to the terms of an EU bailout could sweep to victory in a June election and nudge the Eurozone crisis into a dangerous new phase. The new French president, François Hollande, called for a European pact for growth to balance out German-driven austerity measures in his inaugural address today, hours before taking his challenge to the Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin. The United Nations nuclear watchdog and Iran will meet again next week after what was termed a good exchange of views during 2 days of talks on the Islamic State's atomic programme. At least 21 people were killed today when Syrian security forces opened fire at a crowd in the central town of Khan Sheikhoun during a visit by a United Nations monitoring team. At least 42 people, including 30 Islamist militants, were killed in Yemen last night and today as the government pressed ahead with a new US-backed offensive against insurgents in the south. Iran has hanged a man it says was an agent for Israeli intelligence agency Mossad, whom it convicted of killing one of its nuclear scientists in 2010. European helicopter gunships attacked a pirate base on the Somali coast today, destroying five speedboats in the first such airborne strike on land by the anti-piracy force. And an explosion on a bus in a commercial district of Colombia's capital Bogota has killed two people and injured several more. It wasn't immediately clear if the explosion was the result of a bomb attack. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. Well, former British Army Captain David Blakely today breaks a 10-year silence on a top-secret and daring mission he went on in 2003 during the war in Iraq. He tells it in detail in his book, Pathfinder, a Special Forces Mission Behind Enemy Lines. From the book's own publicity, no backup, no air support, no rescue, no chance. However, I'm delighted to say that David Blakely survived to tell the story and is with us now. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here.
By all accounts, your account, you shouldn't be here. You were put in such a tough position by your own commanders.
Absolutely. I mean, the nature of the unit, the Pathfinders and, you know, other British special forces and elite units is to be in dangerous positions. You know, that is part of the job. That is part of what you're trained to do. However, we ended up on a mission right at the start of the Iraq war where we deployed deep behind enemy lines to conduct reconnaissance on an airfield and mark landing zones for British and American paratroopers to come in. However, the intelligence which we were launched upon for that mission proved hopelessly wrong, and there were basically thousands of enemy forces in the area, and we ended up on the run and cut off and abandoned.
Completely surrounded.
Absolutely surrounded.
Now, I know that you parachute in under all kinds of circumstances, but on this mission, had you gone in some sort of vehicles?
Yeah, we had. Parachuting, the kind of parachuting that we would do was called Halo and also Hey-Ho. It's the kind of James Bond parachuting that you see. Actually, James Bond did it last night. It was on TV, Tomorrow Never Dies.
Hey-Ho and Halo, we can't just let that sit out there,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. Halo is high altitude, low opening. It's where very special forces guys, it's been in the film Act of Valor recently, jump out from the back of a Hercules aircraft at extremely high altitude, and you have an oxygen mask on your face, and you free fall for about a minute and a half until your parachute opens, and then you glide together as a team of guys in towards a target, and you usually land about 10 kilometres away from an objective, which might be an enemy position that you're going to conduct reconnaissance on or attack or call in fast air to basically put a strike on that position. Hey-Ho is then high altitude, high opening, where the parachute opens immediately at extreme altitude, and you can then cover great distances under canopy. The Ministry of Defence won't permit me to disclose exactly what altitude we jump from or exactly what distance we can cover under canopy, but suffice to say, you can cover great distances and therefore you can cross borders.
And under canopy means under your
Under the parachute, yeah. So it's basically the ultimate kind of covert method method of deploying special forces type soldiers.
Okay, thank you for that. But I took you off your mission. You were driving in.
Yeah, so on our mission, there was a lack of kind of political and military will for us to deploy by this method of insertion. It had hardly been used at the time. It hadn't been used in years, actually. It's now used extensively by, I'm not allowed to say what countries, but basically many countries around the world. However, we were sent in by vehicle. There was a real lack of air assets, including helicopters, in the British Army, and there still is. And that's obviously quite alarming, given that we're under more defence cuts now, and our soldiers, I believe, are at a lot more risk, you know, more than ever, really. We were sent in by vehicle, and the intelligence that we were sent in proved wrong, and that we basically drove straight into a hornet's nest of thousands of Iraqi Republican Guard, Fedayeen, and SSO. SSO is their secret police, effectively the Gestapo or SS of the former Saddam's regime. So we ended up getting shot at and abandoned, and ambushed all over the place. We then got pinned down and surrounded. I called in for air support to British command and was immediately told there was no air support available. I asked again and was told no air support available, without a request, I believe, actually being sent through to the British Air Force. I then asked for a rescue team, again told instantly not available. So we were effectively abandoned and on our own.
How many of you?
9 of us at this point.
Just a small unit.
Just a small team.
At great peril.
Yeah, at absolute great peril, yeah.
So what did you do?
We had to discuss what we were going to do to try and get out of this. We couldn't go east to the airfield by vehicle because we were boxed in. The area of this where this operation took place was north of Nasiriyah. It's Babylon. This is the Garden of Eden area. So it's not just vast open desert. There's lots of canals, rivers, streams, palm trees everywhere, which makes it very difficult terrain to cross. We'd seen 200 Fedayeen in 15 Toyota pickup trucks coming after us. We come off the road, we'd gone into cover and put a snap ambush in place when we basically cut the engines and cover the road with our machine guns. And we'd seen 15 of these vehicles go past looking for us with about 200 Fedayeen. We didn't want to go back because we'd stirred up this huge hornet's nest. However, when we discussed what to do as a patrol, one of the team members said, if we end up on foot, I believe we're going to bump into villages. We're going to bump into stray dogs and shepherds. And he said, remember Bravo 2-0, the book by Andy McNab, which there was some controversy over that story being told. And there was lots over my book as well. But this guy in the patrol said, remember Bravo 2-0. As soon as those guys were on foot, the net started closing in. Their intelligence was wrong. And it was only a matter of time before they all got captured. So we learned from Andy McNab's book. And I think that was a great thing for that story to be told, which again was cleared by the Ministry of Defence. And what we decided to do was make our way all the way back to the front line without any air support and fight our way through all of these enemy positions. And we went through 4 major ambushes and 1 contact with enemy Fedayeen minibuses coming at us. And we had to shoot through all of this opposition.
You did. The 9 of you.
Yeah, the 9 of us. I was shot through my trousers. There's a letter in the book Pathfinder from
Prince Charles.
From Prince Charles, yeah.
Looks like he sent you a bottle of scotch, I think.
He did. He sent me a bottle of scotch from his personal vault. It's still at my family's home now. My father saved it for he and I to drink someday in the future.
So you're waiting.
Absolutely.
I don't know how long a bottle... But look, the question that has to be asked, first of all, you've broken a code in a way and a tradition in speaking out about this. Mm-hmm. But having done that, why on earth have you waited for nearly 10 years?
Yeah, I think I didn't have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so I'm not gagged as such for life, so I can tell the story. I believe that after a period of time, that the public does have an interest in these stories being told. First of all, what my guys achieved is incredible, absolutely amazing. And although the mission was a disaster and it failed, the guys getting out of this situation, and once we had actually discovered the exact coordinates of these enemy positions, this information was then passed to the Americans, who within an hour launched airstrikes onto these positions. So the actions and efforts actually saved countless American lives. And so I think the public have a right to know that, but they also have a right to know that when these guys were sent on a mission, when they were trapped and surrounded, they were actually abandoned and no effort seemed to be made to get them any air support or any rescue team. And I think it's important that people know that, particularly at a time when the armed forces are facing even more cuts and our troops are going to be in even more danger. I think after a period of time, The risk to any operation or any individual decreases significantly, and the Ministry of Defence cleared my book eventually after a long protracted period and were happy that it could be published.
Well, I'm sorry to say we've got the wind-up signal now. We've got to go, but lots more questions, and we'll look forward to reading your book and hearing more about this.
Thank you very much.
I thank you for joining us today. That was Captain, or formerly Captain, David Blakely, author of the new book, Pathfinder. We'll be right back with a song.
Bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries.
Dance.
You are cordially invited to tune into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition, we celebrate the art of wandering with writer and psychogeographer Ian Sinclair. Enjoy live music from Astrid Williamson, kick-ups and dusty grooves in Chicago, and a lead through a chaotic maze in Paris by Jean Deloisy.
You have all the transformation of the self-portrait of Picasso slowly becoming a minotaur.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
And now another song for you. This is Miracle by Astrid Williamson. And that was Miracle by Astrid Williamson. Now it's time for our daily chat with one of our star Monocle editors, and today it is Jonathan Openshaw, our business editor. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Nancy.
And you've got some business on your mind, I gather.
I do. Well,
how clever of me to know.
Since that is the section. No, yeah, I mean, we talk quite a lot on Monocle 24 about the huge opportunities that are available for luxury brands in China. We've talked about Richemont Group growth, LMVH Group growth. They kind of double figures every year. But an interesting story out in the FT yesterday, which we wanted to take a bit further, is the launch of the a new Paul Smith flagship store in Shanghai, 5,000 square feet. And it's an interesting story because what it opens up is not just the opportunities in China, but also the dangers for European brands as well, because Paul Smith has opened there before and has had to retreat from the market after heavy losses. So we wanted to talk a little bit about how actually, you know, China's a land of opportunity, but it's also risky. A land where you need a real strategy and you need a real sense of purpose. And that is what we're here to talk about today.
Well, that's great. Thank you. And at that, we've got somebody listening in right now with us. It's Ben Knapp, who's a senior consultant with Safran Consultants. Are you there, Ben Knapp?
Hi, how are you?
We're very well. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Jonathan.
Hi, Ben. I wanted to start off really just to get your take on the news that came out yesterday. I mean, what do you think of Paul Smith's chances?
I think they're probably better this time around than they were last time around, for the simple reason that the kind of target group that they're probably going for specifically with their jeans brand, as far as I could tell from the story in the FT, has probably moved on quite a bit from where it was 5 years ago. So I think they will do better this time than they did last time.
Mm. And interesting, they're working with the Hong Kong partner this time round, with Imagine X. How essential is it, do you think, to have work with these real kind of local expertise, work through franchises as a way to enter into these huge but potentially dangerous markets?
Well, as far as my own family in China on the ground tells me, this is a very successful group, so I'm sure they know what they're doing. Also, their expertise in the sort of department store retail area will surely lead Paul Smith to find probably the best locations. Tianjin is the first city to start in, certainly a good first move that indicates that these guys really do know what they're talking about. And of course, having the right partner on the ground from our own experience in Saffron is crucial. So if you have that, then and the right timing, I think they've got two very, very good factors working in their favour.
Mm. And obviously at Saffron, you're experts in kind of advising on brand strategies. And what do you say about, Western heritage brands going into a market like China? What do they need to look after the business as well as the brand, potentially also protect themselves, have a bit of an exit strategy, as well as anticipating this surge in growth? How can they keep a sense of their Britishness, especially for a brand like Paul Smith, which is so idiosyncratic and eccentric in a way?
Yeah. Well, if you look at how well Burberry has done, and if you look at the shop attendance in throughout London and throughout Europe in Burberry stores, how many of them are now Chinese, and how many Chinese have come over to Europe, specifically to London, to shop for the traditional luxury good brands that have now almost seen a resurgence thanks to that in the middle of this terrible recession. I think China, as you said earlier on, is a huge opportunity. And certainly the more traditional English luxury brands will have done very, very well so far. I think brands like Paul Smith that do take a bit of a quirkier perspective on traditional British fashion are going to be doing well now, because the people that are, shall we say, between 25 and 35 that may well be Paul Smith Jeans target audience, I don't obviously have intimate knowledge, but that's what I'm assuming, will have now moved on beyond the traditional Burberry as it once was and all the other British luxury brands, and perhaps looking for something to differentiate themselves amongst what you might call the moneyed classes. So it's
Ben
no
Knapp,
good
I'm
enough.
Sorry to jump in like that. We do have to go, but thank you very much, Ben Knapp, consultant with Saffron Consultants, and Jonathan Openshaw. Thank you. And that was Jonathan Openshaw and Ben Knapp, as you just heard. And earlier today, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, caught up with Monocle editor Andrew Tuck, who's been in Paris for a big conference on cities and urban concerns. Here's what they had to say.
Andrew, thanks for joining us from Paris. Wonderful Paris in the spring. Is it spring-like where you are?
Well, it's been gloriously spring-like to about half an hour ago when finally me and David Michon, the nice producer who I have with me, nipped out to get a coffee, and suddenly it had gone cold and it was beginning to rain. So we were a bit disappointed we haven't topped up our tan today.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. We're all very disappointed for you as well. tell us a little bit about who you've been seeing in the last 24 hours.
So as you know, we're at the New Cities Summit in Paris. And today we've had some really interesting meetings. We met with a guy called Fahad Al-Rashid, who is one of the people developing the King Abdullah Economic City in Saudi Arabia. Now, his vision is that Saudi Arabia has a big population, unlike the Gulf states, a booming population that needs somewhere to live. And it's a very young country. So their vision is to build a whole new city, which will be based around a port. And he said that actually even the way that Saudis are living together is changing. So more women are working, there's more kind of double income couples, and they're not living in the way that their parents did. They're moving out of big family home compounds, and they're looking to live in a more kind of Western style. So it's apartment style living by a port. And the port's interesting as well. The port is going to be, their vision is that you can change the way that we ship goods around the world, just as the Gulf states change the way that we fly around the world. So they want to be the kind of Etihad of shipping, in a way, that they want all transshipment to happen via this port that they're building.
And how easy are they finding it to actually get people to move, though, to a brand new city that they're still trying to construct?
I think at this point it must be pretty tough, asking people to move to a building site. And when you think of the size of it, it's not building a small town. They're building something that will eventually, they believe, be the size of Washington. So far they only have 27,000 people living there, and even next year they say the figure will only get up to kind of the upper 30s. But it's next year that will be the key point, because that's when the port opens, and that's when they're really hoping suddenly people will realise there's lots of jobs there. And they've already persuaded 12 leading Western companies to set up headquarters there. And I guess that's done with kind of the promise of kind of free real estate and good grants. But even so, they're beginning to try and move people to this city. And I think the other thing that will help them is that the kingdom has announced they're going to build high-speed rail, and the high-speed rail will run all the way from Riyadh through Medina through Jeddah and will stop on its way through the economic city.
Bring us a little bit closer to home, a little bit closer back to Midori House. I understand you've been talking about mayors in the UK, a country that doesn't really have many of them at the moment.
No, so we met Greg Clark, who's the Minister for Decentralisation in the Cities in the UK. And you'd imagine he wouldn't be a very happy man because, you know, we just had these referendum the other day looking at whether UK cities should have elected mayors. There was an opportunity for 10 cities to choose a mayor and 9 of them said no. So only Bristol kind of went with the plan. And there has been some stuff in the press in the UK saying that, you know, his plans are really kind of doomed on that side. But he seemed to be, you know, he said he felt that the tide was in his favour and that over the years, by best example, that more cities would begin to kind of vote to have their own mayors. And it's interesting that he's here with the mayor of Liverpool, Joe Anderson. Now, these two people are from parties which are rival parties, and traditionally Liverpool has had a very difficult relationship with the Tories. But both of these men seem to be in partnership, and they both were here to kind of say, yeah, actually, good mayors can change the way that your city is run.
In a sense, do they both have something in this, in that obviously Joe Anderson wants, you know, to be a success as mayor of Liverpool, and Greg Clark perhaps wants Joe Anderson to be a success so that more cities then think, OK, this is the way we should go, we should have mayors?
Yes, and, you know, the language was interesting. You know, Greg Clark was saying, yes, I'm kind of happy if over time for, you know, more powers to devolve to the cities. But of course, you know, he'll be more cautious if those cities don't live up to the promises that they're trying to make to their electorates. And actually, Joe Anderson was saying, yeah, I'd like more powers, but I'm very well aware that we have to prove that we can deliver. So they're both trying to get something out of it. But what was also interesting was that you realise that even for, you know, a city that's had tough times like Liverpool, a good mayor can begin to kind of market itself abroad in a way that isn't dependent on the nation it sits in. So Joe Anderson is actually looking towards China. He's trying to see how the city kind of can tap into the money and the resources from there. The city has traditional links with China, of course. But there's massive port developments on the cards. And he believes he can push ahead with those things and change even the kind of unemployment rate in his city without relying on central government.
Does he feel that he has more clout now, both with central government and internationally, as a mayor than he did a month ago when he was a mere council leader?
Yes, I asked him that. I asked him what the difference was between he's obviously been the council leader and now he has this this title of mayor. And he seemed to imply that, you know, it just kind of made you change your game a little bit, that he realised he now needed to be much more of a global ambassador for the city. We're here at this city summit, and he said that he would be lobbying for this organisation to bring the city summit to Liverpool over the coming years because he wanted to do more things that kind of branded the city. Now, he doesn't seem quite as much of a maverick as other London mayors, the London mayor rather, such as Boris Johnson, or even a Bloomberg or Mayor Delannoy, where we're sitting in Paris. But even so, you could see that he was beginning to kind of shake off his old coat, as it were, and trying to place himself much more as a kind of a more charismatic person to kind of lead the city.
Now, you've also, I understand, found a new friend.
Yes, Douglas Copeland, the author we all know from Generation X and another 13 books, I believe he's written, is here, and he's here with the city of Vancouver. He's very good friends with the mayor of Vancouver, and he's somehow got involved in a tech project for the city, which is going to see hundreds of these little pillars built across the city, which are going to be masts for mobile communications. They're going to be recharging points for electric cars. But anyway, he seemed more keen to kind of make some friends who weren't perhaps wearing shiny grey suits. So he met me. We bumped into him last night with David Michon, and we're going to meet him later on today because he said he was going to hold a place on his dance card for us.
That was our own Andrew Tuck speaking from Paris. And that's all for today's Midori House. Thanks to my producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Jakes. In 3 hours, that's 2200 London time, Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will be here with the Monocle Daily. Up next is the news, followed by this week's episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald. You've been listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham. Goodbye.